Now this thing disciplines what kind of oscillator? Do you need this thing to discipline?
Okay, I better explain now what they mean by discipline. Even before they modify the receiver, many receivers will have a output pin which gives you an extremely precise one pulse per second. So you take your 10 meg reference oscillator, count it down to 1 hertz, take the one pulse per second coming out of the GPS receiver, and compare them over a certain length of time. I'm guessing it takes them 5 minutes or so to come to a conclusion. They set up a phase lock loop-like system between the two with a very long time constant to the error-correcting signal that's applied to their reference oscillator. But within some small number of minutes, they get their reference oscillator down to parts per billion. Back to you, Joe.
Okay, well, I don't have one of those. I just have a test room that's able to monitor frequencies off the electric service monitor, so that's what I was trying to simply come up with some sort of way of using that to measure something off the air that I could say, okay, this is measuring this frequency, it's supposed to be on this frequency. If my service equipment is off, then my equipment must be off. That's basically what I was trying to get at, not buy some more equipment to measure frequencies by. But I guess I'm kind of stuck, aren't I?
Maybe yes, maybe no. Let's check with John. John, of all the measuring you've done, I can tell that what Joe is looking for is a UHF frequency, something greater than, let's say, 100 megacycles, over-the-air broadcast, that has a known accuracy that he can use with his counter to precisely align the reference oscillator of his counter. That's what I think he's looking for, or something like that. But John, when it comes to frequencies above 100 megacycles, let's say, and the closer you get to 1,000, the better, do you know of any over-the-air broadcast that Joe might be able to find that has a known precise accuracy of something like a hertz or a few hertz? KD2VD, K2LIW in the TechNet.
TechNet from KD2VD? No, I do not. I do all my frequency measuring with respect to WWZ, which is transmitted at 60 kilohertz. And my frequency standard that uses that signal is completely homebrew. It disciplines a 10 megahertz crystal oscillator. So essentially I could take that and I could multiply it up, or I can take harmonics out of that if I needed some sort of a reference at a higher frequency. But if you're out in the cold or you're in the field, it would be kind of nice to have something at a high frequency that you could use as a standard. Even if something like that were to exist, you would have to be very careful that you're getting a good ground wave reception of that signal, because anything like airplane flutter would probably cause some errors in that frequency measurement. You've got to watch out for that at VHF frequencies. There are some people who actually measure that airplane flutter Doppler shift that's caused by that. I think there was an article in PQ not too long ago that discussed that. K2RW in the tech test from 82ED.
Amazing. So you're using 60 kilohertz, WWVB. I'm guessing it takes you 10 or 20 minutes of listening to that channel with the ionosphere going up and down and giving you some phase shift. It must take you some significant length of time to get your reference oscillator into the accuracy you're looking for. Is that approximately true, Joe? John, sorry. John, K2BD, K2LAW in the TechNet.
It takes several minutes. It doesn't take that long. And part of that time is just getting the crystal oscillator, getting the whole phase lock loop around that crystal oscillator going. And another part of that time is just like heat up of that crystal oscillator as it's powered up. I'm using a voltage controlled temperature compensated crystal oscillator. It's not up to control, so I have to wait a little while for it to stabilize a little bit. But within several minutes, I've got a fairly accurate standard. And I've used that with some off-air frequency measurement receiver gadgets that I put together to participate in frequency measurement tests. And several months ago, I checked out some AM broadcasts, and WCBS at 880 kHz is spot on. The WSAN at 660 kHz is spot on, and I think it's WWRU at 1660 kHz is spot on. I haven't checked every signal I've picked up that I can pick up at this, you know, I'm 50 miles from those signals, those stations anyway, but they are, there's reasonable for the viewer, let's put it that way. K2RW in the tech net from KD2BD.
Okay. One other thing I've got as a suggestion to you, Joe, is that the 15 gigahertz receiver that's used in the, can't think of the name of the product right now, Qualcomm is the company, San Diego, California. They make a product, I think it's called OmniTrack. This is a product that's installed in 50,000 tractor trailer trucks. It's a Ku-band downlink satellite linking system that allows a truck driver to communicate directly to and from his dispatching center so that while he's driving on the road, they can send him a message to the satellite that says the 405 freeway has a blockage at exit so-and-so. They bypass such-and-such so you're not wasting time sitting there in traffic with your expensive vehicle. And oh, by the way, make this other stop at this particular warehouse and pick up the such-and-such product. So the two-way communication is taking place by way of a Ku-band satellite, 15 gigahertz satellite. In order for that to all work well, there is a 10 megacycle precision crystal oscillator assembly, TCXO like thing, VC-TCXO, which is built into that receiver. A whole lot of those receivers have appeared on the surplus market, and the guys who want 10 gig equipment have been taking those 15 gig transmitters, 1 watt transmitter, and modifying them, making some minor snowflake modifications to them to bring them down to 10 gigahertz. But that 10 megacycle reference oscillator has built into it a lookup table. First of all, they started off with a very well temperature compensated 10 megacycle oscillator. And I think it's got an oven in there, but I'm not sure. No, it's got no oven. It's got no oven. It is temperature compensated so that for a reasonable amount of temperature change, the frequency doesn't change, but built into it is a lookup table where it measures the temperature, goes to the proper point of the lookup table, readjusts the voltage on its varactic diode inside, and notice to pull it back on frequency. I have heard tell that people using that oscillator at 10 megacycles have never found it to be more than something like 0.5 hertz wrong at 10 megacycles. And on the surplus market, those things are selling for numbers like $20 and $30. Would that kind of accuracy be good enough for you in your particular environment, Joe? W2RYY, K2RYW in the tech net.
Well, I suppose that's something similar to what I can set my thing right now, and I just looked at the thing at 10 and 15 megahertz. WWD looks like it's about less than a half a hertz off from that thing. I'm not using a frequency counter, Dick. I'm using a service monitor, which has multiple different things it can do, but it has a receiver in it, and it has an SSB function with the receiver. That's how I can tell if I'm locked onto a frequency or not by the pitch either way, or I can also measure an AM on a 0 to 30 hertz scale either way. But you were right about the cell site stuff. I used to be able to measure stuff on the cell site frequency band, either A block or B block, and those carriers were within 1 hertz frequency. So that was a pretty good standard to go by at 880 megahertz, but those are gone. They were pulled off the air as of the end of February, so can't use those anymore. I did look at CBS a couple minutes ago while you were talking, and I can see, extremely slow variation in the frequency between my equipment and that frequency. But, if I tried to get my equipment on channel by using something like a very low source, even WWE, I'd still be off if I wanted to try to measure something much, much higher and be fairly precise in the frequency measurement. Yes, if it's 10 hertz, 15 hertz off, or even 50 hertz off either way, you're going to say, what does that really matter? Well, it matters to me because I like things being accurate, don't you?
Yes, I do, Joe. And it depends on what I'm doing. Some of the things I do don't require that accuracy, and some of them do. I'd love to have the ability to have a couple of hertz of accuracy at 10 gigahertz. 10 gigahertz is 10 1 part. Yeah, I'd like one part in 10 to the 9, one part in 10 to the 10. I don't have that. Don't have that. So I'd like to have that someday. And from all the people that I talk to who need that, the majority of them are doing it by a global positioning satellite receiver. Because that is directly traceable to the bureau. Okay. Good stuff. Good technical stuff. Hope we haven't put anybody to sleep with all this jazz. Mel, what would you like to talk about tonight? What has your mailbag been saying to you? And you've got the floor. And I'm going to give a quick call to Paul, WS2N, if he happens to be on frequency, for a space report. He might not be on frequency. I didn't hear him sign in tonight. So a little bit of a delay, and then please pick up Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the tech man. Oh, we didn't need that much delay. Maybe Mel got called away. K2KEY, are you there, Mel?
Roger. I thought maybe you were copying something on the input, but I don't care. It's always possible to throw out the island up here in Brooklyn. Okay, yeah, I just have something doing all kinds of things here, but listening very carefully. Years ago, they used to have a frequency measuring test that the ARRL used to run, and I used to participate in that, and what I used to do to calibrate my BC-21 frequency meter at the time, of course, really talking about real old angles, or I'm sure you even think of anything like that at the time, but to set it up, I used to do the color TV test, disable the AFC going to the color oscillator so that it would float just the oscillator then until, I should say, the correction that the faces were blue or green, that it looks normal when I say, okay, that's the proper setting of the oscillator, and then, of course, that was my standard thing. So, all right, let's get things changed since then. Question here about radio. All right, vertical with radio. Like, discuss that over.
I just heard, Mel, that's always a good subject, and we've said it quite a few times. If you're building a quarter-wave ground plane antenna, or constructing, or you know, putting a kit together, and you want high efficiency, lots of radios are required. As such, I've lost some faith in quarter-wave ground plane antennas. I've got more faith in a half-wave horizontal, and if you've got the real estate, a half-wave vertical. But a half-wave antenna, I think, gives a lot more bang for the dollar if you've got the physical resources to do it. Back to you, Mel.
I can only go by what I have. I have one vertical. I have a 65-foot vertical. I use my BDD down at the low end to my low band DX with 100 radios buried, and it performs quite well. I've compared it to my loop dipoles in the past, but for the long haul DX station, to really thing them out, my possibility, because of, you know, it's not as directional as my dipoles that I had up, I could really get the new dipoles maybe the optimum angle or whatever. But the vertical and the change happens to be working quite well. The question here was that I want to buy with a company that buys the vertical, offers two size types of radio, a number 18 and number 22 wire. Why or which or should I use if I'm going to bury the radio? Does it make a difference? What is the size of the wire over?
I think it doesn't, Mel. On the assumption that the wire is not going to be cut through during the installation or rust away or corrode. The thinner wire is a little bit more vulnerable to being broken, but on the assumption you're not going to get mechanical breakage, I think 22 versus 18, not a great deal of difference. Yes, it's a little bit more resistance in media 22, but when you've got a good number of them in parallel, I think that problem primarily disappears. See, the ground resistivity you get is a significant number of ohms, whereas the 22 gauge wire for the lens you're running, and it's only the resistance very close to the apex, very close to the center of the antenna, is the only place where the resistance really counts. Out at the tip of the ground plane radial, there could be a whole lot of resistance in the wire, and you wouldn't know the difference. In theory, the impedance is very high out there, so to speak. Now, I did hear you say you got 100 radials down. I am curious, Mel, how you chose the number 100, and did you get a chance to do any intermediate experiments? In other words, you first laid down 5, then you laid down 10, then you laid down 15. I wonder if you had a chance to see, as you went up toward 100, was there any difference? Or did you just bite the bullet and lay down 100? And 100 radials for an 80-meter ground plane, that takes a significant piece of property. I'm a little bit guessing that you had to bend some of them over a little bit because I'm not sure you could fit them all onto your particular street. Over to you, Mel, KQLIW.
Okay,
funny
you should ask. Very unique situation happened here. Some years ago, I'm going to go back and say about 20 years now, they came along here and they ripped everything out, and I mean everything out here, because they had to put a new storm sewer in here, and that this was considered a flood zone. So out came the street, sidewalk, garden, you name it, it was just gone bare here. And they pulled out the original storm pipe here, emptied into the ocean down on the corner. Of course, that was a major source of pollution here in the Atlantic Ocean, so they had to make a complete changeover, take all that out, and redo the piping system, fairly large diameter pipes, and run them across from here, across Brooklyn, to the plant that processes raw sewage. Actually, this is where storm drainage. Now, the when the streets and everything is out here, I saw this situation. I said, wow, I got a golden opportunity now to put the radios down. And so what I did, with the help of that time my neighbor, I was doing work at the time for the telephone company. We were doing quite a number of contracts, mainframes for them. And so what I was able to do is get a length of the wire that they use. That's this wire that's, I don't know, maybe an inch and a half in diameter. And it's got thousands of pairs of number 22 wire. The guy said to me, I said, they're a piece, give me, say, 65 feet long. They said, yeah, I guess so. He said, yeah, let's take a look. Yep, sure enough, I got home. With this thing spread out in the driveway, cut the sheathing off and pulled out all these number 22. There was hundreds of pairs of that project. So I dropped them. Then with the help of my neighbor at the time, who used a rake, while that was on a weekend, they stopped working on a Friday afternoon. I knew I had till Monday before they come back and continue to work. Now the sewer line, pipes were in. And so I just laid out the radio, fanned them out from my CPA. And all right from the way the vertical system. And the band amount just kicked dirt over it. Prayed that when they came back Monday, they weren't going to do any more digging or whatever. And they did. They just laid the new street right on top of it, buried the whole works. And I wound up with terminated 100 radios sent over.
Wow. What an opportunity. My goodness. Of your 100 radios, are about 40 of them out under that macadam, out under that asphalt under your street?
They all fanned out from that one spot. They're not out at 360 degrees, I must say that. They're out at, let's say, at least 200 something, because the other way would be I couldn't go under the house with them. I got them up in the garden, the side garden. That I have inside the house, they are going, they just, actually I put them down and just laid them there and they just disappeared into the ground. They just migrated underground. So the only ones that are missing is the one that would be going directly, that would be under my house. There's just enough, no way, of course, I could get him in that direction. So they just fan out about 220 degrees to take over.
I'm getting the impression then that your 80 meter quarter wave ground plane radio is in the front yard. Is that true, Mel? The ground plane, the quarter wave ground plane antenna is in the front yard?
Precisely. It's camouflaged very, very well, because unless actually pointed out, you never really see it. It's actually hidden behind a big tree, a 65 foot evergreen tree. That's where it's hidden behind. So you only look at it a certain way, you can actually see the top of the vertical. I took a lot of pain to make sure it's well camouflaged so I don't get any so-called interference. Not QRM or QRF, but you know what kind of interference. So, like I say, streaking fell out, I was able to stretch it easily out 65 feet in all those directions. No problem whatsoever. And the vertical didn't even exist at that time. This was future for future. This vertical didn't get installed for years later. This was just laying dormant. Dick, it was just a chance, like I said, the futuristic antenna. I couldn't resist, over.
As I said before, golden opportunity. Your actual 65-foot high vertical itself, is that one piece of aluminum tubing? And is that directly in front of the house or just behind the sidewalk out in front of the house? How did you do that, Rob? No, go ahead.
What I'm about to tell you is going to shake your head. I actually climbed that tree up all the way up. I've got approximately 15 feet of coal that is standoff from the main stalk of the tree with PVC standoff that holds the that vertical in place with straps that go around the tree, loosely fit but are stopped by the branches actually. And I have a whole slew of them. And then the vertical is a number 8 wire that continues down to the ground level there. So it's not a pipe that goes strictly up there, but it was a lot of fun climbing and doing that. It was quite a scene, to say the least, over.
I'm sure Mr. Schneider was a little bit unhappy with that one. Now, since you've got the pipe attached to the tree, wire attached to the bottom of the pipe, and that comes down to the ground, does that wire have some kind of a spring mechanism to accommodate the fact that the tree on the windy day will sway back and forth on Mel's grass?
It's got a variable spring floating on the tree. Everything has to be. I got hanging from the tree also a pulley. That 40-meter guy pole comes from up there also from a pulley that slopes down the 20 would make, say, 28-degree slope of the ground. I have that on here. Then I have another one that sneaks off on another angle. That's the 30-meter slope guy pole. So I've got a number of things, but they're all plenty of movement. They could go back and forth. Nothing that, you know, pull tight because it would surely lose the gain with the tree swaying your antenna. It's going to be the loser, that's for sure. But it was quite a sight to go up any of those heights, even up. Oh, this week, in fact, I crept up some power this week, and I rewelded that broken guy ring that that branch had taken down. Dick, over.
Do you own a portable welder that you're able to strap to your back and climb the tower and then do welding now? If so, impressive.
No. I haven't got a portable welder like that. I just got a welding machine. It was actually the welding machine you may have seen as a red bottom piece of equipment. It was actually made for the air conditioning industry. These guys that install central air conditioners up on the roof of the places have a portable welding unit that they can hook up right to either 110 or 220 systems, you know, the 20 outlets or whatever they have up there on roof, and then they weld together, you know, the support to hold the central air conditioning doors in place. So it's portable for that. You can't put it on your back. But what I do is with a pulley off the tower, I pull it up like about halfway up. It hangs there like that, and then I just pull the welding, you know, the cable grounded the clamp onto the tower, and of course pull the other with the sticks go in, the welding sticks go in. You know, I pulled out with me. I did it because this week was, the weather was, you know, not too hot, because to get up, you've got to wear with your welding, and, you know, you've got to be really protected, otherwise you're going to get burnt up. So I figured that I would roast and I'd get up pretty soon over.
You must have been a pretty sight with that get up, going up there doing arc welding. An arc welder with full protection suit and the mask up on a tower. A neighbor with a zoom lens and a camera could have gotten some great pictures.
I had a couple of, not welders, people, neighbors watch me weld, a couple of guys who instructed doors over, they're building a house there. In fact, they were doing welding, they're putting railing in. And they have to be, when I came down, they were clapping their hands and said, good job. So you want a job with us. not quite. But, that get up, you got it with the jacket, with the gloves, and the helmet, you know, and you're dragging the cable with you, and I got the rods and my side up in there, and so you got to wear the right shoes and all this. Yeah, the shoes you got to wear, you got to make sure those sparks don't set anything on fire, because they'll burn, you know, any kind of material. It's sparking away, a hot spark. So I was thinking about this, and I dreaded thinking about going up there and doing this with the safety belts on and all, but I said, it's got to be done. There's no way I'm ever going to get this, you know, fixed. It's just something they got to do personally, I think, over.
How big was the chunk of metal you had to weld up there, Mel?
The rings, you know, they when they put this tower together, they put these guy rings on the outer leg. They have these round guy rings that, and the way they welded them on, I always looked at that. I said, I don't know. I got like sort of cheapy. I never liked that the system they have there, but that's the way the tower came, so that's the way it went up and everything like that. But I always said someday I think I got problems here. Because, you know, the surface area where the ring is actually welded to the leg of the tower, it didn't look heavy enough, Dick. So what I do is I make a loop. I take the torch and I bend out of pieces of, pieces of rebar. And I bend the loop so that it's got like a, not a round loop completely, but like a looks like just if you wrote an old sign, Dick, can you picture that over?
I sure can, an ohm sign, the Greek letter omega. Go ahead.
And now those two legs from the central loop, that's what I welded. So I've got like 3 inches or so, or 4 inches of each side of that loop that's now welded to the leg of the tower, rather than just a round ring welded in place over.
That's pretty good. And that's where a guy cable goes to that loop?
In fact, when I put it up and I saw that originally, I didn't like it. And what I did is I took a piece of steel cable that the guy cable, and I ran it through the ring and around the leg of the tower, and I put one of the, little clamps, one of those cable clamps on there. Sort of as a backup, always in the back of my mind that, gee, one of these breaks off. Oh, I'm going to have myself a catastrophe here. And because it looked so cheesy the way it was, that flimsy. And sure enough, when that branch came down, it exerted, imagine the force that branch weighed quite a bit. And it just snapped it off, and that's what held everything together, is that backup piece of cable took over.
Well done. That backup piece of cable, it itself had, I hope, more than one guy clip on it, Mel, because I think a single guy clip does not develop full strength of the guy wire.
Well, what I did when I put it up there, I put that clip around and all, and I would just touch the rod, just weld the end, back onto itself there and all. Put a little welder in to do there, because they didn't have really that much room to get through those clips in place. So, because I didn't want any clay in it, I wanted it tight so that the ring pulled away, there would be no flashing, really, of the guy. So, I didn't have room for it, but what I did is, I just took the torch and put a little of silver solder, I think, or something I used at the time. I think I used a brazing, some sort of a brass brazing stick over.
Yeah, most guy wire that I've used is galvanized, and if you do any welding on the guy wire, you burn away the galvanizing. Outdoors, that's not so bad. Do that indoors, and it makes a gas that's very noxious and can do a lot of lung damage. But when you do welding, brazing, or whatever of galvanized material, you then have something that's pretty bare steel that's capable of rusting. So you probably put some rust-preventing paint on top of that. Is that what you did?
Anytime I, when I'm on the tower, I had to do some scraping away too, because I had it to the ground, clamp on the welding. So after that, what I do is I give it a spray, zinc chromate, and then aluminum paint on it. The tower's been aluminum. I painted the tower a couple of times with aluminum paint, because even with the galvanizing, it starts to pit, it's tough here by the ocean, the ocean, that constant bit of spray, I'm sure, is coming off there. You see it picked everything. Well, you should see there was a railing along by the ocean, along the walk there, used to be here along the Atlantic Ocean. They had a nice railing. The whole railing, the whole length of it is gone. By the beach, they have also a railing along the certain part of the walkway there. That railing disappeared over the years. Nothing. Whatever's left there, you could just crumble it in your fingers. And that was pipe. Was actually an inch and a half galvanized pipe that disappeared there, over.
Yep, salt spray is wicked stuff. Galvanized pipe is not going to last forever. Galvanizing on towers is not going to last forever. Probably requires painting periodically. I make sure that all my antenna hardware is either aluminum or stainless steel. And a little bit of galvanized material. The tower itself, in my case, is galvanized steel, Rhone 55. So, weather is something that we certainly worry about as you live closer and closer to the seashore. When I describe any of these characteristics to the guys that live in the Mojave Desert in California, they just don't know what I'm talking about. They can put a raw piece of steel out in the weather, and they'll see a tiny little bit of rust after a whole lot of years. What a different environment. Thank you, Mel. And maybe you want to go to the next mailbag.
Heard something said coming.
I didn't hear that.
All right. Stationary ahead, comment. Want to say it again? Okay. All right. Goodbye. I remember that experience. Please, I was out there at that monument out there, and I don't really want to talk about that place. I can think that is one of the worst places I've ever seen. That I don't know how anybody lives out there. You can always tell New Yorkers or Northern or Westerners out there, because they try the people living out there. I saw people living out on the desert. I just believe how they live. But I saw those people I know. You can always tell the people that were not native to that area originally, Dick, because they all try to grow grass on their lawns, and it doesn't seem to be something that's possible over.
Well, they succeed for a little while. One of my New York friends, right in the middle of Lancaster, California, built himself a beautiful, lush lawn. And it took him a tremendous amount of fertilizer, water, and everything else to do it. Pretty soon a water shortage came along, and he was restricted as to how much spraying of his lawn he could do, how much watering of the lawn he could do. And you watch a grown man cry to
watch this beautiful lush lawn like the green on the golf course slowly turn into a brown weed.
Actually, I tell you, that place was the most despicable place I've ever been to, one of the worst places that I've ever experienced that. I went out there that time, a friend of mine says, oh, it's a funny, good jobs out here. Well, anyhow, long story short, they can have it on the silver platter, the whole area. like I say, it's really no man's land. All right, shall we go on with something a little bit more in the way of amateur radio, over?
Your choice, Mel.
Looking down here, I'm trying to, you know, look for ones that we can discuss. All right, discuss the ones with the radio situation. Went through that in detail. Let's see. And heard you one day. Yes, heard you one day discussing how you used to do some 50-meter jet and how you looked for band openings using a spectrum display. And he said you made this spectrum display from a TV set. I saw some of this. Somebody showed me some part of it that from your description that was in World Radio some years ago. Elaborate on it. Oh my God, I don't even remember that. Oh! Yeah. All right, you want to say a few words about spectrum display so I can get my thoughts together, how I did that with a TV set, over.
Yeah, for a while, there were a series of articles about buying a replacement television tuner. A modern-day television tuner really has a Virectus diode that tracks the RF and a Virectus diode that moves the local oscillator. So it's a beautiful down-converting assembly which has a pre-selecting filter and a tracking oscillator that allows you to scan from point A to point B over a pretty large frequency region. A television receiver, a good one, will receive easily from 54 megacycles up to almost 700 megacycles in either two or three bands. So these television front-end tuners are not very expensive as a replacement part, and they contain a lot of the hardware that builds a pan adapter or a spectrum analyzer, mostly spectrum analyzer. All you have to do to add on the back of that is something like a 46 megacycle IF strip, and there's now modern-day integrated circuit with ceramic filter that'll do most of that work. So a amateur-rated spectrum analyzer with the right available components these days can be built, I'll bet you, for maybe even $100, not counting the display. And an ordinary oscilloscope properly hooked up could do a pretty good job of display. So I wonder if your article used some of those techniques, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Exactly. This is K2KEY. Now I remember what the article was about. What I did, I took that time a black and white 12-inch TV or something I picked up and had a regular, like you say, a Virectus tuner. What I did, first of all, what I did is make sure the TV set was quite decent. The next thing is, I saved the IF strip intact, the video amplifier, everything intact. What you have to do, of course, you have to notice on the Virectus tuner, there's a number of terminals that were on the Virectus tuner. There's one that's marked D, and then it's marked B high, BH, and then it's marked U. You'll notice that whenever you have to be on B low, down to the BL, the voltage is there. Usually they put a 5 volts or whatever it was, 9 volts, I believe, on that pin. And then if you go up to B high, above like channel 7 and up, you'll see that will switch the voltage then to that next pin. So you mark down all these things. You'll see there's also a reference. There's a voltage test, the reference voltage on the tuner, and a number of other things. So now, the problem, of course, is that the voltages that are in a TV set are usually derived from the flyback transformer. Now, you don't need the flyback transformer anymore. You You don't need the pitching tube, the yoke, you don't need the vertical circuit. So when you remove all that stuff, you've got to resupply those voltages to the IF circuit, to the audio circuit, to the video amplifier, to the tuner. In other words, you've got to substitute that with a power supply so you can eliminate the horizontal circuit, you know, the vertical circuit, all that, which I could say is normally in the horizontal, especially output, the flyback, you've got these voltage takeoffs that are rectified and then used back into the rest of the circuitry. So you have to first observe, you know, what you need to run the bare-axis tuning at all. Once you get all that off and everything, if you'll notice that if you put the correct tuning voltage on that all, you can you'll change channels the same way with a variable control be able to tune the bare-axis tuner actually down to 6 meters on the drop. Now, once you have that, now the only thing that you're going to tack on now, for it to scan, what you do is with a scope, you pick up one of these old 5-meg scopes. Basically, I had an old scope around, and this is perfect for it. You connect the vertical to the video output, and you connect the horizontal, you're going to use the multi-vibrator to come out of the scope. The multi-vibrator is actually becomes your sweep, to sweep the bare-axis tuner. And by that method, what you do is it will, if you put a pot, I think I put a pot in there so you can go like the width and everything like that, but basically what you're going to do now is the, once you set it up that way, I'm trying to remember nitty gritty what I did, how I hooked up the horizontal to the scope to the voltage control. I had the circuit actually called the voltage control, control voltage processor that switches the horizontal, gives you the horizontal rate. Like I say, I have to remember all the details, but basically that's the basis of a spectrum analyzer. You can elaborate a little bit more, I'm sure, Dick, over.
Yes, I'm guessing you took the sawtooth waveform that the oscilloscope uses to generate its horizontal sweep, and you put that exact same voltage, maybe with a isolating amplifier, into your Beretta tuner. So now your Beretta tuner would sweep lockstep with the oscilloscope. So as long as the Beretta tuner sweeps the same way the oscilloscope is sweeping, because they're coming off the exact same multivibrator with maybe a buffer amplifier, and the video output from your, the detected video output from your Beretta tuner IF strip combination went into the vertical plate of the oscilloscope, and the only thing left for you to do is to add two other potentiometers and power supplies in this little black box that did the scan conversion for you, so that you could shift the center frequency and shift the scan width. Scan width could be lowered by using a potentiometer, using a smaller amount of the sawtooth waveform coming from the oscilloscope. And if the sawtooth waveform coming from the oscilloscope was AC coupled, then your second pot would allow the DC voltage on the sweep before it goes to the Beretta tuner to be shifted up and down, and that would adjust the center frequency. So therefore, your pad adapter / spectrum analyzer, you could set the center frequency and you could set the scan width. So therefore, you could decide that you're going to look a whole lot of megacycles around your favorite frequency, or zoom in, so to speak, and look very few frequencies around your favorite frequency. About the only other thing you'd want for a perfect spectrum analyzer is the ability to change the width of the IF strip to go to a narrow resolution bandwidth filter or a broader resolution bandwidth filter, depending on whether or not you want to sweep fast or slowly sweep and see fine details of every signal that's on the band. K2KDY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
You just really said what I did on second generation of this thing. I improved upon it. I added a 10-turn pot with a little circuit control voltage processor. So the 10-turn pot, that was actually my width control, and Yes, it works real well. In fact, you can up, you know, I look at the television channels and everything with it and all, but it was really, I could say, something you can really find in it. Everything really was stuff that got to nothing. The GOAT, old 5 meg GOAT, I see them many times at Amtrak, you know, make an offer. In fact, I had here about three or four of them that we took to the Weimark Amtrak last year. And we sold them for about $5 or $10 a piece. They were working, actually, they were working, but of course they have little or no commercial use anymore anywhere. They were two types of scope. And a TV receiver. And basically, this way, Dick outlined it, it's great because you can just watch the entire sideband section of the 6 meter band, and you see a pin jump up on there. You can tune your radio right to that, the frequency, to tune down and look for and see who that is. So rather than keep tuning back and forth and tuning back and forth, you let the simple circuit tune back and forth. So basically, the TV set is supplying about 90% of what you need, and the scope is really the rest of it, other than a few odds and ends if you want to, you know, really dress it up there, over.
Very fine. Now, let me ask you this question. How close could two guys on the 6 meter band be simultaneously where you could separate them and see them as two separate signals? And in order to do that, you'd have to use something a little bit sharper than the normal IF strip of a television set. The IF strip of a television set is a couple of megacycles wide. I wonder if you did something in there to give it a sharper tuning bandwidth, that you could separate two signals that were close together. Back to you now.
Probably a couple of guys did elaborate on the idea. I saw a number of articles where they elaborated, where they came up with a bandpass filter, you know, and all kinds of, let's see, they stuck, how the heck did they do it? They stuck a low-pass filter in there, and what they did, I remember, one guy, I remember, sent me a whole bunch of paperwork, in fact, somewhere on his file, where he added a wideband amplifier, first of all. Then, after the mixer, out of the tuna, he added a bandpass filter. I think he added about 36 megahertz bandpass filter. Then They twerked it, tweaked it, and everything like that, and improved upon the idea, Dick. You know, there's no end. There's some of these, you know, filters, these crystal filters that came along, 5 megahertz filters and things like that, came along that they were sticking in different pieces of equipment, FM or whatever, and they started sticking in that. For a while, they were pretty popular, the traction over.
Yeah, it would be very tempting to, after the IF strip, put in another local oscillator and beat it down to either 10.7 megs or eventually 455 KC, where you could get some pretty sharp filters, and that way you'd be able to separate individual signals. There are ceramic filters that will do some pretty sharp filtering, but you're not going to get very sharp filtering up at 30, 40 megacycles. I think you'd have to have another stage of conversion, very similar to a dual conversion or a triple conversion amateur radio superhead receiver, to bring it down to a fine IF so you can separate the individual carriers that are on the band. So that's a nice way of finding out when there's activity. A guy who's on the 10 gigahertz band, it's funny to hear him say, hello CQ 10,000 megacycles, 10.368. At the end of his CQ call, he says, carefully tuning the band. But what he means is, I'm going to tune 50 KC up and 40 KC down from where I am, and that's it. You don't want to tune all 500 megacycles of that band. You wouldn't live long enough. KQKEY, KQLIW.
Exactly, this is KQKEY. Of course, you want to elaborate on this thing. I mean, you want to get away, I mean, you know, start with the basic TV set. And then work your way up, of course, you want to get fancy. Come out of the IF strip that then put in, I could say, a second mixer. And that mixture, of course, you can then elaborate with it, maybe a band pan filter and all, and, you know, use another crystal oscillator, say, and reduce it down to, you know, to maybe 5 megahertz or something, or whatever. But then that's getting away from, you know, the concept. The concept was that, you know, you always, most of the time, you looked, you had a baseline, you know, almost nothing really, looking across the sideband portion of 16. And so you would sit there, you'd be doing something, you know, see a little bip jump up, you didn't really care, you knew something suddenly came on there. You see the bip up and the up and down there, you know, there's a sideband station on there, so... you go ahead and tune to it. Actually, I'd say this was a poor man spectrum analyzer, and it was just save you from going crazy, you know, getting after a while the yardage of just tuning back and forth on 6 feet of band. Few of the other guys even went ahead and, you know, were using it, I think, on 2 feet. I think a couple of them told me that they were also using it on 2 feet for you know, station activity in those days on 2 meters, which was very smart, even on 2 meters in those days. This was a lot of years ago, over.
KT2SYL. SYL recognized. Mel, one of the things you can do is the beautiful tuner from the television set tunes to an IF of something like 48 megacycles, 46 megacycles. If you could then pick up a second receiver that was intended to be a scanner at 46 megacycles, which itself converted back down to 10.7 megs and then 455 KC, and then take the detected output of it back to the scope. You wouldn't have to build all those other stations, just pick up another receiver capable of listening to 46 megs. The new station, please give us your call letters again and your name, and go ahead with your comment or question. K2LIW in the TechNet, my name is Dick.
KC2SYL, the name is Bill, Bravo, India, Lima, Lima. A new tech, joined Limark 2 months ago. I've been listening to your tech name. I have a question about Echo Link. I was on last week and it was kind of late and I just ran out of time. And I think a gentleman by the name of Howie answered, but we just ran out of time. If you have a couple of minutes, I'd like to ask you about that. Once again, the name is Bill, call sign, KC2SYL. Over to you.
Very fine, Bill. I'm not very experienced at Echo Link. Mel has a little more experience at it than I do, although I don't know if he uses it a whole lot. But go ahead and fire with your question. We'll do as good as we can. I haven't heard how we sign in yet tonight, but maybe he's listening, and maybe he'll join us after he hears your question. Over to you, Bill.
Thank you, Dick. Basically, my understanding of Echo Link, you need to download software to your PC, and then what I quite haven't determined yet is how to sign on and what equipment you need to connect to your PC. I know you're probably going to need a microphone and so on, but and when I obviously identify your calls at your station, I think all of those good things. But just the basic mechanics, after you download the software, the basic mechanics of how you get onto that system. And the secondary question is, what is IRLP? I just cannot seem to find a complete definition that I'm able to grasp about that. Dick, back to you and Mel, if you have you know, any comments, I appreciate that. This is KC2SYL.
WHYY on IRLP.
You got it, Joe. We're looking for somebody to explain it all to us.
Okay, this is WHYY. My name is Joe. I'm coming in from an IRLP node 4148, which is connected this time directly to the node in Glen Oaks. You can find IRLP information on www.irlp.net. Type it in your browser. You'll come up to the main page and you can read all about IRLP. It tells you how the system works. You can look at the under node info. You can see how many nodes there are, how many reflectors there are, who's connected to what, what's going on at a particular time. But that'll give you all the information on IRLP and basically how that works. I think they have some pretty good explanations on some of the pages the theory behind it, how it works, how you can tie radios to it, and so forth. EchoLink, I've used EchoLink on my PC. You only need a PC and a microphone. It uses your computer speakers to reproduce the sound, and you need a microphone plugged into your sound card. And basically, when you set up the software, when you download the software, get it installed in the machine. Once they, they give you the software, they'll approve you on a list once they just verify who you are as far as call letters, all right? And then you'll be allowed to use EchoLink. EchoLink works similar to IRLP, except you can access it. Some people access it by having a radio tied to a particular electronic instrument that can tie, through your PC, and some just use the PC directly itself. There's like an adapter goes between the radio and the sound card and the PC to give you a push-to-talk action, COSX, between the transceiver and the computer. IRLP is done a little differently, where it basically requires the radio being tied directly to a form of computer that doesn't run Windows. It runs on a Linux platform, but Basically, EchoLink can be used from a PC if that's what you're looking to do. And simple actions to make it push-to-talk, you can set the space bar, for example, to give you a push-to-talk action. Push the space bar down, you're talking. And with the space bar up, you're listening. There are ways you can adjust your audio up and down with some sliders in the software to make sure your microwave is not overdriving and so forth. And then once you get on the EchoLink, you'll see a whole page of hundreds and hundreds of nodes out there and repeaters that have EchoLink tied to them that's available for you to contact. Over to you, WHOLY.
So, I appreciate that. I did go to the EchoLink site, and I did read, on how it's set up, but what I couldn't glean from there or obtain from there easily is just how you set it up on a PC. Obviously, I know I have to download the software and that kind of stuff, and then I have to get a microphone. A question about the microphone, the type of microphone that uses Skype, is that acceptable? And Joe, I have to get your call from. This is KC2 as well.
Okay. Call is Whiskey Alpha 2 Radio Yankee. Name is Joe. Any kind of microphone that will work with a PC will work fine. I'm not sure it's specifically what Skype would use, but I'm sure if it can be handled by your sound card, it'll certainly be adequate for use on the EchoLink. Not terribly critical as far as the type of microphone. Any kind of cheap microphone you can pick up at one of these computer shows, something like that, for a couple of bucks, you can plug in the back. Some stick on the front of the computer, some have a little stand you can angle thing to get the best projection of your voice and so forth. Anything will probably work pretty much fine. I don't think it's that terribly critical. I happen to use one that just sits on the desk, and you can angle it up towards you, and you speak into it. You use push the talk action from the space bar to the computer. It's pretty easy to set up. There is a little bit difference in quality between IRLP and EchoLink. They use a different type of codec to reproduce the audio. And I happen to like IRLP better. IRLP is basically set up between radio to radio link. You can't come into IRLP with just a computer or a PC and directly talk into the system. You have to pretty much have it tied to a radio link or directly to a repeater like you have tied on this particular repeater you're talking on. Back to you.
As for IRLP, when you refer radio to radio, do I have to use my transceiver for that, or just use the computer, and the computer connects with the radio with the IRLP node and contacts the other node? Is that how it works? Joe, back to you. KC2SYL.
KC2SYL, WHOLY. On IRLP, you need a radio tied to the computer, which is called a node. They sell you a board, you buy the board from them, that goes inside a, something you can build up yourself in the form of what resembles a PC, small hard drive, so forth, a small amount of RAM to get it to work right. I believe it requires only 64 meg of RAM to make it work, that's like the minimum. And the connection board is something you buy from them. They give you the software on a CD, which you load into your machine, and a Linux platform in your machine. It's basically what it's based on. It's not like Windows. Echolink runs on Windows. Windows in your PC. You can get Echolink software, put it in your PC, and it'll work right now today with your PC, just the way it's set up right now. I don't think it'll be, I don't know if it works with Vista, but it should work with all the common currently out platforms like XP, Windows 2000, Win98, probably Millennium, and so forth. So I would try that one first, because that's simple to use, easy to set up, and if you just need a microphone, you get a microphone, and you can pretty much get on Echolink with what you have and not have to spend any kind of amount of money with it. There are ways of tying a radio transceiver using what's called a rig blaster into Echolink. You can take a transceiver and buy a rig blaster, and you can sometimes put them on eBay, people selling them, or just type the rig blaster on Google, and you'll probably be able to find some more information about that. That may even be available on the Echolink site itself. It might give you a description of rig blasters, different types, and what's involved in hooking them up. Back to you.
Oh, okay, great. A lot of information. It's getting clearer and clearer. Just one other question about Echolink. I know there are IRLP nodes, and the Linemark repeater has an IRLP node. I believe it's a Selden repeater. If I wanted to access the Linemark repeater via Echolink, do I need a node on there? I'm not sure. I have to key in something. The frequency or what would I have to feed the software with? So back to you. Thank you.
Okay, once you open up the operating software, you'll get a master table of a couple hundred nodes or Echolink users out there. Some are repeaters, some are tied repeaters, some are just people with single PCs, and they're listed because I think R is for repeater and L is for local. Which only just has the title of the PC because they ask you to specify that, what you're going to be using it for, before you before you set it up in your radio. I guess it makes a little bit of a difference to them. You click on the number you want to activate, and then this button you connect with by pushing a button in the software, click on, and allow you to connect to that particular node if it's available to connect to. I don't know if Echolink, I think it does. Echolink will allow you to connect sometimes two or three users can connect node to node if you have the capacity between them. You don't have to be on like a reflector. You're almost like on a party line. IRLP uses something called a reflector where one person talks at a time, but many stations can listen to that reflector channel. But with IRLP, when you're connecting to a node, you can only connect one node to one other node at a time. If you want to have several nodes talk to each other on a round table, it all has to be connected to a reflector subchannel. Just like I'm connected to this particular repeater right now, node to node, because it's not connected to the repeater out in Selden, where it was previously connected on a particular subchannel on a reflector. But if I want to listen in that way, if I connect to that subchannel, I'd be able to hear traffic on this repeater and the one out in Selden at the same time.
Okay, I think I got it. You gave me plenty of information. I do have a standalone PC with Windows, so it looks like Echolink is the first order of business to become knowledgeable about that. And then once I get comfortable with that, I'll probably just go to IRLP. And if I can ask Mel and Dick, the Linemark repeater, Echolink enabled, is that accurate? Back to you.
I think it is. Isn't that true, Joe?
It probably is, Dick. It probably is. It may be installed in the node for Glen Oaks at the same time as the IRLP software in the same box, because they do have that available with the core bridging software that allows you to put two different operating systems, sort of pseudo, in one, one up in one container at once, so to speak, to keep it simple. Whether Glen Oaks actually has a Echolink turned on or it's available, I don't know. I haven't been on Echolink in quite a while because I pretty much strictly use IRLP, which is what I'm talking about now. But you would find it, if it's there, you'd be able to find, look it up on the master table by name or call letters. I believe this is W2 for yellow, I think it's a call for this repeater. So it might be listed either way, but once you find it, you'd know right away. And Echolink generally has a 5-digit number for a node identification. IRLP stuff is generally 4-digit node numbers.
Yeah, I've heard a number of Echolink contacts.
Thanks a lot, fellas. I really appreciate that. As I said, I'm new to the hobby, and some of the terminology and some of it just gets all intermingled. And next time I have questions about CTMF, ECS, and tone. But that's another time.
Don, good questions, and we'll get you some answers of those on the next second bill. We're getting very close to the closeout time tonight, the witching hour. Echolink is operative from time to time on this repeater. I've heard Echolink use those. I believe the managers of this repeater only enable that function during low activity times, like in the afternoon, certainly not during drive time, is my belief. So it takes place here, but just not all the time. So probably some other repeaters where Echolink is enabled essentially 24 hours a day. If you go to the word IRLP as a search set of four letters on Google, you'll find some very nice information. If you go to the Wikipedia IRLP, they've got a very nice section giving you all kinds of explanation about it and VOID and so on. So on the net, lots of information is there. I think we're coming to the closeout time, Miles. This was TechNet number 1184 of the series that began in September of 1982, which is 25 and a half years ago. Assuming that these guys keep gathering with all their information, and Mel and I stay enthusiastic and healthy, we'll be back next week. 73, you all, be kind to each other. Mel, over to you for any possible closing comments. K2KEY, K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, this is K2KEY. I haven't got a number of the emails here to get to, but I'll try to answer some of them briefly. Unprotected, not really great at the keyboard, so that's possibly some kind of a phrase-based problem, but I'll try to give you some brief answers tomorrow, and I will try to get to maybe a little bit more of the emails a little earlier, then get to a few more of it. I know the number is not All right, 73, everybody, have a great week. You are serving the Passover. Have a great Passover. This is